Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Golf Badgers podcast. My name is Sam Cooper. You might know me as an associate architect with the firm of Clayton DeVries & Pont, or perhaps the guy who spent 2 years in a van playing all the links courses of Great Britain. In a minute I'll be joined by my great friend James Bledge, who is the course manager at Royal Liverpool Golf Club, preparing for the Open Championship in a few months' time. And we're joined today by our guest, Jim Croxton. Long-time listeners to the podcast may have already heard of a short interview with Jim, which we did just before BTME earlier in the year. But we're very lucky that he's come back for a proper interview where we discuss his career, the greenkeeping industry, bigger and all they do to support it, and also the future of the industry as well. So if you're a greenkeeper or if you're just interested in the industry, hopefully you'll find this chat particularly interesting. So thanks very much for listening, and without further ado, here's our episode with Jim Croxton.
Basically, I remember you said you really wanted to be on the Badgers podcast. I'm going to call a badger because you're a badger. Was that?
Tell us exactly why you're a badger.
So Jim applied for
you don't say bad. I'd have to look at look bad.
A second repeat appearance on the podcast.
Then do it as much as you like because I'm a dude.
First one from the badger mobile was it a success?
Well, that was a Harrogate special, was it? And that was the first.
We can deep dive in a little bit more about you, a little bit more of a bigger, and we can talk about the course season.
Yep. All that kind of stuff, and we could talk about today as well, what we've done. But we could start about talking about our tipple for tonight, Sam.
Well, should we welcome people back? Because it's been a while since we recorded with a guest. We've had a couple of catch-ups.
The thing is to talk about what you're drinking.
I'm drinking Innocent Gun. Session IPA. I think last time you asked me that question, it was your advent calendar.
That's been a while.
That's how long ago it's been.
Got on the drink. But it's the Innocent Gun IPA is what I sampled for the first time at an R&A meet in the evening. I might add.
Not during the day.
Yeah.
It wasn't going that badly.
No. And it was in the Trin Marine Hotel. Lovely hotel, and it was the Innocent Gun IPA, which I've never had before alone at the lager. And the glass I'm drinking out tonight is the Innocent Gun lager glass that my mother stole from Wetherspoons Dumfries. It's the first it was ever stolen in her handbag, and she was gutted.
She was unintentional steal.
Her speeding fine sense, so she's a legit.
Does this mean you come from a criminal family?
Big time, yeah. you gotta watch her, but yeah. Let's welcome everyone back now.
Well, everyone, welcome back to the Golf Badgers podcast. My name is Sam Cooper, and I'm joined not only by
James Bletch,
but also Jim Croxton of Bigger. Jim, would you like to introduce yourself and welcome to the podcast?
Well, thank you very much for having me for a second time. I feel slightly embarrassed that I'm a repeat visitor so soon. You've either run out of imagination or friends that I've put out, you know.
It didn't take long.
Except is the first repeat offender.
Yeah, I think he is.
Well, apologies in advance. Just to go back onto the tipple thing, anybody who knows me won't be surprised to hear that I have a cup of tea in my hand. I drink about 50 a day. So the Yorkshire, the very nice, Mr. Bledger, is from your own kitchen and it's Yorkshire tea and it's pretty good, thank you. Yeah, so my name is Jim Croxton. I'm very privileged to be the Chief Executive Officer of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association, Bigger, to most people. It's lovely to sit here with one of our members, Mr. Bledger, a recent friend to the association and a visitor to BTME.
A new member. New bigger member.
Bigger member, excellent. I'm sure I should have known.
Associate. Not keeping on top of.
I did?
No, actually, in Orlando.
What was it?
Yeah, I don't remember. You took
I remember you walking about with a form, but I couldn't remember what show it was.
Yeah. We were stateside.
All the way to America. I've got to sign up for Bigger.
Excellent. Yeah, good. Well, thank you.
No, this is good.
I enter it.
I can probably even charge this down to work hours there with both of you.
Perfect. Well, tell us a bit about Bigger then, as a new member. What's the remit, the people who are your members, and how you got involved with it way back when?
Okay, that's a broad question, so I'll try and kind of take it piece by piece. So, first of all, what is Bigger? It is a members association for golf greenkeepers. We're not a union, but we play a little bit of a role in trying to help our members when they have issues in their employment. But to be clear, we're not a union. We are a members association. We are responsible for a variety of elements of a greenkeeper's life. So career development, education, networking, providing events, providing advice and guidance. We do a lot of the things that most associations do. So, insurances, leaver helplines, HR helplines, accident insurance. Sadly, greenkeeping is still occasionally a pastime, a profession. Freudian slip that leads to accidents, and we have accident insurance. And a number of benefits of membership, such that, we believe that anybody that, as a member, if they look through all the things that we offer, they can save the value of the membership pretty much just by utilizing the options on the website. But we have these three kind of strategic aims that are the things that we try to do. We try to support our members. We try to support the game of golf and the health and growth of the game, because the stronger the sport is, the better opportunity there is for our members to be well looked after and well supported. And also, we reasonably kind of modern developer for the association. We try and sort of bring some leadership in the area of greenkeeping to the industry, because we've got such talent in our ranks. We're a 6,000 members, give or take, around 5,000 greenkeepers in the UK, a few hundred overseas members, and a few hundred affiliate members, which Sam is one of our newest. But we have this slightly a bit wishy-washy, but we believe that the point of our association is to try and make the world a better place for greenkeepers. I strongly believe, I'm sure we'll get into this at a later stage, we'll go back a little bit over my time in the golf industry, but I believe the game of golf is delivered by people. It is reasonably unique to all sports in that people at golf facility level provide the game of golf for the 5.2, 5.3 million golfers in the UK and the however many million there are around the world. Greenkeepers is the biggest single workforce within that. And yet they have been probably a little underrepresented and certainly undervalued across the piece. And I think our role is to try and provide that voice for greenkeepers so that if we want the game of golf to grow, we've got to take the people who are responsible for the golfer's enjoyment and the golfer value. We'll take them along with us, and the game's got to wreck. And I believe we're at a pretty crucial point, and we'll probably discuss the issues with our workforce and our latest recruit to our staff, maybe even James. But I think the game is beginning to understand that the people that provide the game for the nation's golfers are A, a finite resource, and B, a resource that's probably dwindling a little bit at a time when we want more. So in a nutshell, that's the role. We're bigger. It was formed officially in 1987. There were three other organizations, an English, a British, and a Scottish, that were working separately, and the RNA helped those three come together to form one business. So that's now, what is that, 36 years the association's been in place. We have 24 staff. We have our head office in Yorkshire, and I've been involved now for, it'll be 30 years this month. So I've been in the industry about 30 years and in this role for about 30.
So and it'd be kind of remiss of us not to celebrate someone else's, which reached a milestone this week with Sani's 30 years, Sani Strupp. So she would have started, how long did you say you've been doing it for?
My first official proper job in golf was 95, so I've been working in golf properly for 28 years. I've been working in the golf industry because I grew up on a golf course. But Sammy's been with Bigger since April 1993.
Extraordinary.
Well, I said to her on the day, because she was actually on the, so she should be on that day, just sent her a message and said, I'm not sure what's the most impressive achievement, 30 years in the same company or 13 years working with me. And she agreed. They've both been a challenge, both had ups and downs, but I mean, to her credit, 30 years in, she works as hard now as she can. You know her well, Bledge. Now a chief operating officer, crucial role in the business, probably looks after more individual teams in our business than anybody else, and just loves it.
No, it just certainly is what you the member they go with, and she represents the association really well. I think every January seeing Sammy's
happy face when you walk up the stairs and the top suites is pretty special. But
you pair up a really good partnership together and it works really well. And she's just been recently promoted as well.
Yeah, she's probably not a load more, certainly not 18 months in that role. And a role that kind of, you know, we didn't see coming. But now when you look back on her career arc, certainly in my time with us, she's kind of moving more and more towards this role. Education, you know, is the bedrock of greenkeepers and greenkeeping and of the success of the developing greenkeeping. I mean, you know, we're sitting here now at a time when there's debates about the new potential rule about rolling back the ball and, you know, the advances in technology. You know, we played golf earlier on and we've all got the lasers that tell us how far it is and whatever else. But the biggest development in golf, without question, over the last 50 years is the condition of golf courses. Mm-hmm. It's just extraordinary. And that's down to a number of things, you know, products, machinery, science, but also the skill and the educated knowledge of our greenkeepers over the years. Sammy's been at the heart of that for the best part of 30 of them. And so I think individually has probably played as influential a role in our sport over the last 30 years as anybody.
Well, there's so many educational events that bigger support and have helped develop. So obviously bigger isn't just PME and a week in January. And you're talking there about Sammy with the education. So what else do you tend to run throughout the year?
How long has it been? Straight, I guess, really stemmed. So we are split into three levels of governance, if you like. So we have what we call our sections, which are our local base. So we have 26 different local areas. You know, Kent is a section where you were before. Mm-hmm. Now you're in the northwest. Devon and Cornwall, Sussex, Central Scotland. So there's 26 of those. I guess on average around 200 members per section. So they will run the average section, an average year, will run three or four golf days. We'll run a couple of educational events of different type, maybe a course walk or two interesting venues. And then quite a lot nowadays of just other stuff. Like there might be a chainsaw course, there might be about temper bowling, we'll go go-karting, whatever they do, ways and means of getting greenkeepers together. So that's at the local level. And then we convene those sections into five regions. So we're sitting here in the northern region, which constitutes six sections. So regionally, we'll have a conference, we'll have a series of road shows, which we started this year over the spring. We'll have some golf events that are at a regional level. And then nationally, we have everything from the National Golf Championship to BTME, which you visited. And then a whole bunch of different initiatives and events, which are aimed at different sections of the membership at different stages in their career. So starting from when you're very beginning as an apprentice, we've got the Toro Student Greenkeeper of the Year Award, which has been running for must be 30 years or so now. So did you do that, Ben?
No, I never, and I was never in a position to do it.
Not good enough.
Well, I don't think I was studying at the right time when it was on. I'm a bit older. No, there's older guys than me that's won it, but I don't think I was doing a qualification, a part-time qualification. Can you do it full-time?
It's level two or level three qualifications.
I did HNC, HND.
Yeah, so at that point in time, I think HNC now is part of it, but at the time it may have been different.
I did, however, have a winner with Nick Machin.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, there's some great names on that list. You know, some of the biggest names in the industry, and then others that have gone into different parts of the industry, and some that's probably the pinnacle, and they've then had very successful careers as, you know, staying more or less where they were and whatever. One or two that have won it, and then we've never heard from 2 years later. So, but a brilliant opportunity. Toro supporting that for Donkey's Year. They support it globally. So they won the same award in a number of different countries. I think he's been running with us just about the longest. Something that Bledge has been involved in on both sides is the Future Turf Manager Initiative. That's sponsored by Jacobson. So it's a brilliant opportunity for, I always refer to it as the old fashioned, well, they didn't teach you in Harvard Business School. So it's taking greenkeepers who are ambitious, who've done their probably at least level three, maybe in a deputy position or coming towards that position, but need to understand what it takes to get that course manager job and to succeed in that course manager job.
And is that something you apply for?
Because
we'll have plenty of younger greenkeepers on the start of their career who will want to learn from you, Bledge, and definitely you as well, Jim. So those kind of things, is that something that you work towards and apply for in time?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an application process. You need a nominator who can be your course manager, could be somebody you've worked with, can even be a member of bigger staff if your relationship, which occasionally is the case, where if you have a course manager who sort of isn't into that sort of thing, you can talk to us and see if we can nominate you. It's quite elite. Only 20 people a year get through it. So we're about 10 years in now. So we're somewhere near. What year did you do that?
In year one.
Which was?
13, 12.
Yeah. So we'll be somewhere near 10 years in now. So 100 people gone through that. Incredible, you know, the success of that. I mean, that first year, I think John McLaughlin was on that same.
John was, Tom Brealey from Sandale.
Yeah.
And it was in the garage part of the, whereas now it's in the Alan Sugar boardroom.
Yeah, absolutely. It's held down at Ransom Jacobs headquarters in Ipswich. And that first year, we were in a kind of workshop area, which worked fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a couple of years later, we moved into the sort of the boardroom end, which is probably a little bit more conducive to some of the management training that goes on as part of it. But it's really cool because and I just said the word cool live, and I'm a 50-year-old man, so I must stop doing that. It's really good because we have mentors as part of the process. Okay. So that very first year around, selecting four or five guys to be there so that and I remember someone saying to me years ago, you've got to see it to be it. As the father of a daughter now, and understanding that particularly in a lot of industries as a female, you sometimes got to see a role model that you can understand and imagine being. Yeah. So to have mentors in the room rather than just, you know, teachers and trainers. So that first year, I think Lee Strutt would have been.
Lee Strutt, Mike Sawicki.
Mike Sawicki, yeah.
Matt Plester.
Matt Plester. Yep. You know, top guys with great careers who are now in, you know, in world-class jobs. And that allowed those 20 young assistants and deputies to look at that and go, right, these guys, I can learn from these and understand. And sometimes it's about, you know, having better agronomic knowledge. Sometimes it's about having better knowledge of how to manage people. But more often than not, it's about rounding out your skills and understanding that, you know, sometimes the rule book you're playing by isn't the one that you expected to be written out. You know, the reason, I remember John McLaughlin, to use his name again, telling me a few years ago about the way he approached getting his job at Wallasey and some of the things he'd learned in his time on FTMI about trying to set himself apart. And he went like way beyond the extra mile to get his first job, at Warrington, and got that job. And that career just took off from that moment. But he really put himself out and went to great lengths to get that. And that's the sort of thing you learn.
I think that people typically have the same, I don't want to use the word shortcomings because that sounds negative when clearly these guys are some of the best in their demographics. But are there certain parts of the rounded skill set that people tend to be good at? And are the themes in which they tend to be slightly weaker at that they improve, or is everyone a little different?
I guess everyone's a little different. I think, anecdotally, so every October, around October the 1st, we release the education program for Harrow BIP, the Contention Learn program. 240 hours or so of education, which will turn into 7,000 hours of people, you know, bums on seats in classrooms. Huge, the biggest, you know, event for Green for Education Europe-wide. And without fail, every year, the first courses to set up and fill are either incredibly practical, they are the mechanics or irrigation courses, or they are the high-level agronomics. So we'll have a professor of some of the states. This year we have Frank Rossi and others. I think Fred Yelton was across. And they always set out first. And yet all the feedback I get from employers of the golf industry is, Jim, your members are brilliant agronomics, they're brilliant technicians, but what I want them to do is to manage people, manage money, and manage communications. We put on a myriad of courses across all of those, and they're the slowest to fill because people's natural instinct, except for the highest performing people, is to go and practice and improve their strengths.
Yes.
And not polish their weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
The very best of us, and I don't include myself in that, I always try to improve our weaknesses and just rely on it. We know the strengths are good. And so the thing that I think I've noticed that sets apart the very best in our industry is communication in particular. So the management of people, you have to do that in a management role and you have to be able to maintain a budget. But the best communicators seem to rise to the top.
Yeah, and John, you've mentioned it a couple of times, but John is great at that. Glad you're not too bad at that, I suspect. I keep going to see. Great lens with the Shore Hill stuff and your blog that you've got for years.
Mm-hmm.
Dale, how many blog entries did you do?
Oh, hundreds actually. Yeah, I think I was I just finished doing a little piece for maybe the next bigger mag about communication because I was lucky enough to win that award that's fallen off the wall conveniently. But that was
I thought leadership award.
Yeah, well, I mean it. I've always really been into it because it's it. When we're talking about weaknesses, I've got quite a lot, and yeah, that is my strengths. But it's kind of bailed me out of a lot of situations where I really believe in educating not only staff but the members as to what we're doing. We were talking about earlier. Stopping Chinese whispers, being transparent and letting it come from the horse's mouth. And I've carried on through here and just trying to kind of develop it a lot through the Shore Hill app as opposed to just standard blogging or Twitter posts or whatever. But we've also done the podcast and a members podcast as well, but just try to kind of find different ways. But yeah, communication for me is absolute key.
So what do you use now, like skill-wise? That perhaps before you were doing FTMI, they weren't part of your job. You know, they weren't things you use day in, day out. Your communication skills, obviously, one of them. And budgeting, if you're now running the thing, but there must be other things that you learn now over that process that you didn't need beforehand.
I've got a thought on this. So occasionally in BTME, we've run a... either young greenkeepers or new greenkeepers at a session, usually kind of half a day or something, as a way of, I'm always conscious that there's a group of young or new greenkeepers. Sometimes they're, you know, they can be quite senior, but they're newish to the trade. They're coming to BTME for the first time or second time. They're probably not going to go and take the Frank Rossi, you know, high level agronomy course. They're probably not going to go and do a full day course on budgeting. They may not even have much of a budget for their own training. Some of these guys are apprentices earning, you know, pretty low wages. So we try and put something on, we charge something like £10-15, which covers their lunch or whatever else. And we try and give them some bite-sized bits of learning to try and really give them the tips to understand if this is a career they want to have, what are the key steps. And a few years ago, I don't know quite why, but I was asked to sort of say a few words at it. And I thought, well, what can I do? I mean, yeah, we've got some great people looking to talk to apprentices and young greenkeepers about this. But I said I wanted to give, you know, two or three thoughts from my understanding of what really helps you develop a career. And something that I think Bledge has done, and I think nearly all of the sort of successful course managers that I know and some superintendents globally, is understand that what you are judged by as an operator, whether that's as a manager, as a course manager, as a CEO, whatever senior role you may have, is very often not the things you expect to be judged by. So most of our members believe and wish that actually the thing they're judged by is just what's out there. How good is the golf course? How good is the ball around me? But it's not that. It's much more complicated than that. It's how the golf course is perceived. It's how much your customer, whether that's the membership, whether that's your board of directors or owner, or whether that's the visitors, depending on the mix of your business, what they expect and how close you are to matching or exceeding those expectations. And also, I mean, we all know people that are just the best communicators that get out in front of every issue. We know greenkeepers who may well be talking a better game than they're actually delivering on their golf course, but their members think they're brilliant because we've got one of the best, you know, this, that, and the other. Mm. You know, and the facts may not even bear that out. But actually, if your employers think you're doing a great job, and your members do because of how well you communicate everything, then you tend to be judged by that. And I think one of the things you learned at FTMI, I'll try to attend FTMI every year, is that you're learning all these things that are the unseen rules of the game. The rules of the game are, understanding how important politics is in your role. Yeah. So we're sitting here at Royal Liverpool Golf Club, you know, you will have 600-700 members, if not more. I wouldn't say that 500 of those don't matter, but 500 of those almost don't matter because they're just going to come, they're going to pay their money. They're never going to be on committee. They're never going to complain.
They're ambivalent.
They're pretty happy. They're pretty happy. They come here. They love being a member here, whatever else it is. There's 100 or there's 50 or in some cases there's 10 who are unbelievably influential, way more influential than they should be. Bear in mind they're one member, one vote, whatever. Your job as the course manager here, as well as having a great relationship with your general manager and with your deputy and your team or whatever else, is to make sure that group of members, however wide it is, thinks positively about you. And if they think negative about you, you find a way to try and redress that. You can't keep 700 members on side, but frankly, you don't need to. You just keep 650 of them you can forget, and you need to work on the other 50. That's politics.
Mm.
The same is true in association. I wish I knew every single one of our members. I don't. I can't. But I've got a pretty good handle on the ones that are influential in the way that Bigger develops, and the ones that have got a loud voice in certain areas. If we find that there's somebody in the association that's unhappy about something, and that their view is gonna potentially, you know, carry some weight, we try and get in front of that. We try and go out and find that, protect that guy out. We ask him what the issue is. Let's talk about this. Let's try and work this out with you, because those are the challenges that you as a court measure. I don't know if you learned that FTMI, but I know you do it, because that's what you did a deal. You know, you would probably have been one of the most popular within their membership court marriages in our industry, because I've been there and seen you working at that. I've seen you out at the golf course working at those relationships with the key members.
I think that helped because I was able to be in front of house a lot of the time. The secretary and the board felt it was important for me, a member of the club, playing the tournaments. I worked a Saturday, which meant I was around the membership as well. Always there at dinners, being asking questions, and you're still working, which is what I do at Hoylake as well. You know, about the dinners, and we spend a few hours talking about the golf course. And yeah, it's massively important, and it's communicating downwards to your team, communicating upwards to the membership, and we do that through many different ways. But I'll never shy away from someone asking a question. It's very important. We do learn that well at FTMI, though. It's very good at that, and I think it's a bit of a shock to some of the students as well, I think, when we do our scenarios, etc.
And you've seen that on both sides of FTMI, as the student, the mentor.
I think it's been actually a lot more difficult being the mentor. You've got to be switched on 100% of the time. I mean, you can sit as a student and take it all in, but as a mentor, you really need to be taking it in and answering questions and be on the ball. And I felt I learned more being a mentor, and it was a great honour to do that.
Yeah, I think you were the first to go from delegate to mentor, and there's been a few since then. And that's brilliant, because again, for the delegate, they can see that progression. Think, wow, this guy was sat here, you know, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever it may be. I could follow that path, which I think is really inspirational. And one of the things that we really want to do as an association is to inspire those that are looking to be inspired. And I think we do that at Harrogate, we do that at FTMI, I think we do that with some of the other things we do. Blair, you've taken advantage of a number of our initiatives. Another one would be the Bigger delegation to the GCSAA Conference of Trade Show, which you attended this year. Sam, you know, we've taken 10 guys away every year now for over 20 years. Bernard and company have supported that for years and years. But that's transformational, and I'll use another name. Remember, that's not too far from here, was the Crone Flies. I remember meeting Rob Sanderlands, who's now
performing. Oh yeah, yeah.
Back not long after I started, and him telling me that in 2010-ish, when he was ready, he was a deputy, he was ready for that step up. He was applied for every course manager job under the sun, just not getting anywhere. And he went away, got on the Bernard delegation, and went away with a bunch of guys, most of whom were already in a course manager position. And he soaked them up. He asked the right questions. In the end, he learned just from that 1 week experience what it took, what he needed to do to change the way he was approaching these things to come back. He basically got the first job he applied for and returned. He went to Great Jervis Sands Golf Club up in the sort of the
Lake District.
Lake District, yeah. And now moved on to Formula A's, where he's done an unbelievable job. Unbelievable job. Yeah, he's great at it. He's got all those roles on merit, absolutely. But he would credit the experience of spending time with his peers in, I think, Orlando that year, and having that opportunity to soak that up and spend that time with people.
So isn't that great? Because I suppose human nature would generally, you'd say, oh, well, you know, I'm great, I deserve this job, and they're not getting it. They didn't understand, it's their fault, and a load of people will probably have that default position, rather than actually what Rob said of, oh, maybe there's the skills I'm missing here, and then spend the time, develop a bit further, and then round yourself out. And then look at him now, he's one of the great in the Northwest.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that we absolutely believe sort of sets aside those who've been hugely successful in this industry and those that perhaps haven't, has been that ability to do to communication and politics. I think another thing is self-awareness, self-reflection. So I think you've got to understand where your weaknesses are and be prepared to ask questions and be prepared to be humble and take a kicking now and then from your peers on some of this stuff. Because one of the things I do notice, so every year we'll have applications for something like the Bernard's process or maybe the TPC Sawgrass process, the John Deere initiative we do. I mean, this year we've got hundreds of applications for Soarus. It's gone through the roof. But on average, we'll probably have 100 or so Berlin applications. And the first thing is a paper exercise, answers or questions, and then 20 at interview for the 10 spots. And ordinarily, of the 10 that don't get the place, seven or so of those were pretty close. You know, if they come back and improve, they've got a really good chance. And I would say that on average, only two of those reapply. Five of them go, well, obviously not for me then.
And it's a process, isn't it? That's the thing. It's you need to get your foot in the door, because there's other people that have failed the years before that are kind of queuing up, that ready for their second chance. So
taking on the change,
it's a big thing. It cost Berners pay a lot of money into it, and Bigger probably do as well. I'm not sure what the script is, but it's I think there's a lot of time. If it's not money, it's a lot of effort.
Oh, yeah,
and you don't get nothing. You don't get someone for nothing, you know, so you kind of keep trying for that. And I think it's...
And not lose, you mean, not lose hope if you don't get something first time round.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, because if your attitude, and I don't want to get this personal, to there'll be somebody might listen to this who's applied to this and thinks I'm going to go over them personally, but, you know, if you don't get the first job you ever applied for, and then you never apply for the job again, then you're stuck to go.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't know exactly, Blair, you know, how many times you apply for different jobs on your route to where you've got.
No, loads.
I've applied for and failed to get a number of jobs over the years, but you keep thinking, okay, what will I learn from that? You know, what do I do different next time? Now, some guys might think, do you know what? I did that burn down this for me. I'm going to wait 3 or 4 years. I'm going to come back better prepared. I understand that and fully support that.
Cameron McMillan broke my heart at Queenwood once. That's the job that I wanted, first assistant at Queenwood, and I thought I had it in the bag. And I went, I remember phoning in this night at King's Barnes, or was it at the time? So, and I said, it went really well. I think I've got a good chance here, and I didn't get it. It was heartbroken because I really wanted it.
Yeah.
I'd always wanted to work at Queenwood. And but it's just as well. But you're right, if you don't succeed first time, you've got to try again.
Yeah, and I think trying, and I'm always really cautious saying this because I know that, you know, a lot of your audience and this is people from our industry. But a lot of greenkeepers, so when we interview guys for most of our initiative, we often like start with a life story. How do you get into greenkeeping? And so many of our people kind of fell into it. Some fell in love with it, you know, where, you know, it happened to them, you know, their father worked in the industry, or they had a chance to work at the local golf club or whatever else. They just loved it and they went with it. Some have ended up in it almost by default, you know, they... school wasn't going great or whatever else, they come into it. But it's an interesting industry. You know, it can be quite isolated. It's small teams very often. You know, if you work at St Andrews or Wentworth, okay, it can be a big team. But even within a big team, very often it's a small team. You know, you're working in small groups out on the golf course a lot of the time, only coming together with great talent. And so, you know, the amount of time you spend working on your, what in modern parlance is known as the softer skills, understanding, you know, communications, politics, all of those sort of things, issues, which is pretty limited. You guys get great at the agronomy and particularly the technical skills side. I mean, yeah, like I sit occasionally amongst greenkeepers and they start to talk about irrigation systems. I just haven't got a clue. I just don't understand those in the slightest. And yeah, I'm always in awe of the technical knowledge. And then we can sometimes have a conversation about, you know, politics within a business and within their facility. And I'm kind of
switched on.
Was it been at all? I'm thinking, wow, guys, you know, I learned this early days in my career working in the PGA 100 years ago. If you don't get this bit right, you really mal progress.
But that's like many things, isn't it? I suppose what gets you from day zero in the job to, you know, applying for FTMI, this is kind of what I was getting at. What gets you from point zero to then are probably entirely different skills from the skills that you use on a daily basis. It's like two different careers almost, surely. Like, now it's not about how James Bledge can learn greens and teas and maybe occasionally, but that's only a fraction of your job. Your job is all the things you're talking about, Jim.
Yeah, and that's interesting. You know, the parallel, I think, my career. So I started after university, the first kind of, about second or third job I applied for was to work with the PGA, as it was what was known in those days as a tournament controller. And my first job, I was a baldric. You know, I drove a van, set up scoreboards. I went out and I did the course setup, which I loved. And that may be a precursor to where I ended up in this industry, because it was always the golf course that I loved the most. I grew up on a golf course. I don't know whether anyone taught me this or whether I just worked this out for myself, but I looked around and I thought, what are the things that I can do in this job that are going to set me apart from my peers? So at that point in time, the PGA had seven regions and national headquarters. It probably had 20 people who were tournament administrators, controllers, or directors, and I was the most junior. I looked around, and there was really three things. So, you know, how well you set up the golf course and get pin positions and tee marking set for that sort of thing, right? How well you do the public speaking, sort of presentations and all that sort of stuff at the end of a pro-am or whatever. And thirdly, the annual rules exam. So there was a rules of golf exam, which the PGA had one every year, and they send the best people to the R&A rules exam. And I'd set myself a target of being the best of those three things. A lot of other stuff, which was how well you had, you know, meetings with golf clubs to set things up or whatever else. They were important, but no one measured them. Yeah, they weren't visible. And so I think in year one or year two, I got the best mark in the rules exam. I was getting half a name for myself for the way that I was able to handle a microphone in the evenings, even though I was literally phobic of that when I started. I couldn't speak. I was horrendous speaking for me when I first started, terrified of it. Remember the very first one I did, I literally nearly fainted midway through the presentation. But I've got over that now, and those that know me know that you can't stop me talking. You're probably now, given the chance, probably had to be me back here today. But I looked at those. But then when I got the next promotion I got, those things became irrelevant. So my rules knowledge was then a given and never mattered again. I could have got better and better and better, but it would have made no difference. To get the next promotion, to get into the PGA, I had to start developing really a relationship with sponsors, really a relationship with the key pros. And so you go, right, okay, those are the next skills. That's absolutely parallel to a greenkeeper's career. One of the first things, if you could absolutely bullet straight lines, hand moving from the word go, that'd be something you sit there and say, God, this guy's got the hang of this. You come back and the machinery is spotless. It's been looked after really well. They come back and say, oh, I saw this, I've got some litter I picked up on the golf course. Attention to detail. These are really, really important. I don't know how often players you ground most straight lines with a hand mower, but, you know.
This morning on a triple, Jim, I was firing lasers away there for a reason.
Okay, you get stabilizers on. GPS.
But you're right. It's so that the how it develops into a course manager's job, which is so well taught at FDMI, is a public speaking part.
Yeah.
And the great thing about Harrogate is there's so many people that are really encouraged to do it for the first time that are approached by Debs or Sammy or yourself, and I've done it loads, whether it be at the Young Greenkeepers Conference, and this year I'll be talking, or next year I'll be talking about the Open there. Yeah. And it is terrifying you've got someone like Sean McLean from Birkdale that first ever won last year. Sure, it's completely out of Sean's comfort zone, but then you kind of need to do that as part of a course manager now, and he smashed it.
Yeah.
And it's true, once you start off, and FDMI gives you the tools for that, but it doesn't just stop at FDMI. I always found as well that it's something that carries on. The mentors keep helping you from then on. It's the same at Harrogate. The people you meet there will always help you afterwards. So things like FDMI, Harrogate, Bernards, Sawgrass, Toro Student, it's not just a one-off event. It's something that carries on and on for years afterwards, and it's the friendships you make with that. And that's a great thing, a bit bigger for me.
A point I want to make now, in case I don't know where we're going to move on this conversation, or even when you're just going to cut me dead, but there's two parts for our association. So there's the engaging with the engaged members. So I don't know what the percentage is, but you know, we've got probably 25-30% of my members are engaged actively in CPD on a regular basis. But that means that there might well be 70% plus that either aren't or aren't claiming or whatever, or only pop to the odd event once or twice a year and don't see the value in doing all that. So we've got a really big job, and we're getting great engagement with all of our initiatives. The numbers applying are getting more and more. We've got a record number, I think, this year for Toro Student. We've absolutely smashed the record for TPC Sawgrass. It's going to be a real challenge, actually, to handle that number of applications. The numbers we had last year, for example, for the Open Support Team, and for this year, huge numbers. You know, that people are seeing more and more what an opportunity that is to become part of the world's greatest golf event. But there's a majority of members, and we perhaps go back to that thing we said before about the amount of members in a golf club that are just there to play golf. They're my responsibility as an association, you know, and I have this phrase we use in the office, it's an old cliche, but a rising tide lifts all boats. And so we've got to try, as well as it's engaging with you and helping you, you know, achieve that success you've had and you will continue to have, and you I think you'd be free to admit that you've taken advantage of all the things bigger put in your way.
No, I'm also
like, yeah. You've done that. But I still got to make sure that, you know, our games are getting paid properly. Every facility they're at, they're getting welfare facilities that are worth the name. They're even getting, we get reports. We just did the survey last year on welfare commissions. That was a percentage of members not even being given PPE. It's a legal requirement. You know, they're not getting it in their facilities. So for the sport to remain healthy, for our industry to remain healthy, we've got to rise that tide. So as well as there's a kind of team of us that are developing. You've mentioned Deb by name and Sammy and others in our industry that in our team that are absolutely our MSMs, our local guys doing all this stuff all the time. Increasingly, our role is to work with the home unions, England Golf, Scottish Golf, Wales Golf, Golf Ireland, to work with the RNA. Our relationship with the RNA, I don't think, has ever been better and closer in terms of working with their sustainability department. The sustainability guys, John Kemp, who's running the Golf Course 2030 project, I think really now fully accepts that one of the resources that is an issue for us to consider over the next 10 years, along with water, sand, pesticides, is people. You know, without people, AI and robotics are coming in, but so we're still going to have to program these things and do this work. So we've got a responsibility to improve salaries, to improve welfare, and to also improve the way that golf clubs govern their staff team. We sit here in a world-class golf facility and a club that's very, very professionally run. And I know that within the time you've had here, you've had a couple of challenges in the business where the business has supported you brilliantly in that time. I wish that was the case everywhere, but it really isn't. I mean, there are still golf clubs out there, sadly, where the relationship between the greenkeeping team and the member or the greens committee or whatever is broken. And we're seeing people leave the industry to go and do things. When I see someone leave the industry for a fantastic position, somebody else, absolutely great. When someone leaves and just goes, I was not doing this anymore, I've had enough,
it's bad. I think I feel that as well. It's a sad state of affairs with some clubs. I think it's the respect between board, committee and greenkeeper. And again, it could be down to a lack of communication. It could be down to miseducation between them. But I was asked, as you know, to speak about Augusta syndrome a month ago, and I'd said, there's some other people that could probably be better than me, because I've always been really lucky. The last two clubs I've worked at were links courses, nice at this time of year, and I've never really had memberships that have given me much grief.
Do you think that comes from the fact that you communicate?
Well, possibly that could be it, without a doubt. But
there's things are two way for definite, we will talk to our members. Members have been multiple members leaving the industry or in a difficult situation, and very often the golf club will have some legitimate concerns or some legitimate even complaints about things that have gone on. But nearly always you find a broken communication situation in these clubs. I've always believed, I was taught years and years ago in whatever management training I ever did, I remember someone saying to me pretty clearly, so if you're in the senior position and you and a junior person, junior colleague, and there's a gap between you, the manager has to walk closer to the other person than that person works to you. Your job as a manager is to be flexible, to build that bridge and build, let's say, three quarters of the bridge between me and my... If I'm a general manager of golf club with me or from a greens chairman with the course manager, what I think we do see is a number of people say, well, I'm not changing, I'm the greens chairman, it's got to be exactly as I want it. And that's then difficult, particularly if the course manager isn't as skilled as we'd like them to be in politics and communication.
And it's actually one of the easiest parts of greenkeeper communication. It's a lot easier than fixing machines or fixing irrigation leaks or anything, or finding irrigation leaks,
Nutrition program.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. These are all the really difficult technical parts. Communication thing is dead easy, actually, and I guess FDMI give us the skills for that. And I'd kind of be the first person to say I don't think I'd be where I am without Bigger or for the opportunities I've got through Bernard's delegation and FDMI, the people I've met. And I mean, Harrogate's my Christmas, as you know. I'm absolutely buzzing at Harrogate time. And Sab, you've seen it this year. And you came away from it pretty enlightened as well. So, yeah, I couldn't speak, actually, if you listen to the previous podcast, because I was speaking that much to other people. You meet so many people, but this is what makes it so special.
And we go back to kind of the reason that Bigger exists is to give you those opportunities and hopefully have you reach your potential, which, I don't think July 2023 is your final, but what a potential you're going to reach in just for 3 months' time now. That's amazing. And we'll take a certain amount of pride that we've helped along the way. You'd have got there, but we've helped you get there in the time you've done. But I remember 100 years ago in a former life from the PGA, I remember being asked by a PGA member in the north of England to come and help him in mediation between him and his club. to do with his, you know, a retainer, the old-fashioned way that a golf club, you know, has a pro, they want a retainer, they paid a sum of money to provide all their services. This retainer was pitifully low, and they were trying to reduce it even further. And I went and worked with this guy and spent a lot of time looking at what he did and what a great job he was actually doing for the club. Maybe he wasn't communicating that to us. He could, as a theme always in these things. But we managed to work together and work with the club to not just have his retainer not reduced, but actually in the end for him to increase his retainer by a substantial amount. They valued his services higher. And I remember getting back to my office in XRL and thinking, wow, it made a real difference to an individual there. As a member of PGA staff, working for a members association, it's wonderful now and then to land a big sponsor and someone's going to win a big check. But that check spent the following week on a, you know, a house upgrade or a holiday or paying the bills. But if you increase somebody's, you know, retainer such that they've got an ongoing increase in their living standards, which can make a difference to them as a family, that made me feel fantastic. It made me feel that the association had a role to play.
From that peace of mind, that meant yes, well being.
And the job he's then going to do for that golf club is going to get better because he's going to be happier at work. He's going to provide the better service or whatever else. I feel the same really strongly. And one of the things that attracted me now coming to work for Bigger was that without which it's kind of over-dramatize it, there's nobody else helping greenkeepers. Nobody else is out there trying to do their best to improve greenkeepers' conditions, salaries, terms, welfare, governance. It's down to us. So I think it's an important job because, you know, I've had the privilege of being out of that golf course today with you two guys. Thoroughly enjoyed it despite the inadequacy of my game. But because the pitch had been prepared and they've been prepared beautifully, you know, so it's such an important part of our industry.
Can I ask a difficult question, which hopefully, well, I don't think there are many people better placed than you, Jim, to be able to answer this, but something that we've talked about on this podcast in an episode that's gone by is the general state of the greenkeeping industry and recruiting staff and new people coming into the industry. What's your sort of take on the state of play at the moment and other things that you're doing to help try and improve it, if there are ways we can improve it?
Yeah, so I think there's a broad question. The state of greenkeeping is actually not dissimilar to the state of a very wide number of industries across, particularly across hospitality and leisure. It's not just greenkeepers, but that doesn't mean it's good. You know, we're in a pretty difficult situation. You know, last year, over 50% of golf clubs running with fewer staff than they wanted. A massive bonus post-COVID that, you know, clubs, the average number of staff they wanted to have on the team had gone up by about 1.5 people. That's fantastic. You know, the boom in golf has led to a boom in the need for greenkeepers. Our ability to deliver that was, you know, is probably lower than it was before COVID, so that's a challenge. As you know, we've recently hired somebody to work on our specific workforce project, and by coincidence, her surname is Bledge. And she's not very far from us now, and she's just starting, you're only a couple of weeks into the role.
But it's not my mum.
Get her teeth into that role. So we're going to do a few things on that. You know, we started with License the First Green Initiative, which the Americans have, which is bringing school children into golf courses to expose them. That's a long-term, you know, potential solution to getting people to be more aware of greenkeeping. Visibility is an issue. I have been saying for a while now, I said it pretty recently in a meeting in St. Andrews with all of the governing bodies of the game, recruitment is a challenge, absolutely, but retention is a bigger challenge. We've got a bucket full of greenkeepers with a hole in the bottom, and the tap at the top is currently running slower than the hole in the bottom, is laying the greenkeepers out. We've got to plug that hole. And there are three reasons that, as far as all of our research would suggest, there are three reasons why people leave the industry: some combination of salary, welfare conditions, and governance. It changes as you go through the ranks. So in the more junior roles, it's predominantly salary. You know, you can go and earn more elsewhere, maybe in slightly more social hours and not having to work weekends. As you go through the ranks, welfare and how you're treated as a member of staff becomes more prevalent. We don't see too many course managers or reasonably senior individuals leaving because of the money. Not that the money's perfect by any means, but course managers are generally significantly better paid than assistant greenkeepers, obviously, and it's not money. But actually what it comes down to then is a combination of the welfare conditions and then the way they are governed, managed, supported within and respected within the industry. So we're focusing our own efforts in more recruitment-based issues. So First Green, trying to have a better influence on the GTC, which works on apprentice standards, trying to promote the industry better at that level, working more closely with the golfing media and other media around promoting the roles and the colleges. But then our role as an association, working with all the other associations of the game and the employees in the game, is to really try and make a step change in the way that greenkeepers are. And the key word for me is the way they are valued. So that doesn't always mean pay. That just means the way that they're valued. Now, when you go to the best run facilities, they really value their staff because they've worked out that the staff actually make the job easy. There's that old Richard Branson cliche quote around, you know, you look after your staff and they'll look after your customers. You don't look after your customers, you look after your staff and they do it for you. The best clubs seem to get that and they seem to really value their staff. Doesn't mean you're not put under pressure. Doesn't mean you're not challenged. Doesn't mean sometimes budgets are tight. But actually, if you feel valued as a member of staff, you want to do your best for your employer. If you feel undervalued by your staff, that is the key, by your employer, that is the key reason why most people leave. And as we move through generations, and you know, I feel for you guys here because you know, most of our force managers have multi-generational teams. I was at a presentation recently about generations in the workplace, and there's a phrase by somebody very official, and I'm trying to remember who it was, but says every new generation is a different people. So they are different. Every sort of 15, 20 years, you have a whole different set of people. The new generation we're dealing with now, my kids will be in that time, was it probably Generation Z? What they're looking for from their career is 100% different to what you were looking for. You know, what am I? Am I Gen X? I think I'm Gen X or something. You know, so...
Are you a millennial, Bled?
No,
I'll be a millennial.
You're definitely a millennial.
I'm 79.
Yeah, you might just be... I'm 72, so you might just... I think we're both in the same generation, so...
But it's true, isn't it? Like, there'd be guys that are on the team who have never known life before the internet or before I was probably just in the Axelot, but remember dialogue from not having a mobile phone, but anyone born after me really weren't.
Well, and one of the things that... So in the last 5 years, I don't think I've interviewed anybody for a role who's not asked me what are the development opportunities within bigger? What's the career progression from Ken? Right? Now, I don't think I interviewed anybody who asked me that question in the first 20 years of my career. Wow. In the last 5 years, that is now a thing. Mm-hmm. And so people are ambitious and they're impatient. And the greenkeeping structure, as things stand, you know, has been fairly... There's a flat bottom level. You then got one at first assistant, maybe. You've got a deputy and a course manager. If you've got a team, as you've got here, with say 12, and you'll have a different structure than this, but you've potentially got 8 or 9 people on the same level, all buying. Mm-hmm. And if they're Generation Z, they go, might have never moved on in 2 years.
Yeah. And patience is someone I see very common.
Yeah.
And do you think that with the impending doom and gloom of pesticide restrictions and banning chemicals that we really actually need, especially a lot of the kind of wetter parkland courses, tree line parkland courses, and water restrictions, which would affect me here on a Lynx course, well, pesticide would as well, to be honest, you know, definitely. Do you think that's going to turn a lot of greenkeepers? Do you think we'd lose greenkeepers through that? Because it's going to become a lot more a stressful environment where golfers are still going to expect the same standards, but with no pesticides, which for me... I mean, Sam, as a member, what's going to happen when you go there and we have thatch fungus on the greens and we have daisies and dandelions and the fairways?
It comes back to, again, communication. Because I think that I'm in the fortunate position. I have played more than my fair share of golf courses.
A lot covered in weeds and disease.
Yeah. But does that mean that I walk off and think that golf course is crap?
No, you would probably... I know what you're like and you would love a lot of these places because it's not about that.
Because it's not about that. But I haven't always been like that. It's only as I've sort of, dare I say, evolved a bit of appreciation for the things that I now know that I value. You know, I value the architecture. I value what the course is trying to make me do. If a golf course is a bit scruffy in places, I would much rather play a fun, engaging golf course that isn't this sort of scruffy than one that's manicured to the hill that's boring.
You're in the smallest percentage there, aren't you?
I don't know.
I think a lot of people...
I'm an extreme of it.
The people that play a lot of corporate golf, I mean,
yep.
there's so many of them that people are playing a lot of the Belfries, the Wentworths that are used to that, and that you would never ever see it before.
The idea of what makes your golf course is fed to them from the PGA Tour, what they see on the television. And the more that you can communicate and educate, and they can see different types, and they can go somewhere and go, oh, this place is terrible. Look how scruffy it is. And then they play a few holes and they have, actually, I really enjoy this. The more that can happen, and granted, that's not going to be everyone, of course it's not, but the more people that can happen to, golf lasted for hundreds of years up until this point. No. It's only in the last few years that people have become so snobby about perfection that they might not play a golf course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was fine 50 years ago, 100 years ago.
Well, you watch all the old people open reruns on Sky Sports, and the courses look completely different.
Did someone in the 1980s not like golf because there was some bare patches on the fairways at Hoylake?
Mm-hmm. And cool. But they'd never experienced how good it is now. And to go backwards now, the question is really, for me being a course manager, how am I going to feel about that? You know, because I've seen the highs, I've seen the course when it's been presented at 8.5 or 9 out of 10, which is the highest a greenkeeper will ever do, because we'll never be higher than that, because we're perfectionists. But I think I'll take it quite hard to go, if this does happen in 5 years' time or whatever, I'll take it really, really hard to go out there and there's weeds and disease everywhere that would kill me.
I do think it's interesting how golf courses will fundamentally change, because let's face it, there are a lot of golf courses out there. There are lots of golf courses built in that era in the 80s and 90s. A lot of golf courses were built, perhaps not our man that's best suited for golf. And I think that COVID probably papered over some of the fundamental cracks in the industry. Not the industry necessarily, but in golf in general. And it's interesting now with my architecture hats on how we're seeing places that probably wouldn't have been viable as golfing businesses, how they're looking to try and change, adapt, compete, maybe sell a bit of land and reuse a bit of the golf course, try and end up with a better golf course at the end of it, but thinking outside the box for the long term. These aren't all multi-million pound golf courses with massive budgets. We're working at some tiny places with small budgets on small parcels of land, but they're still looking at how they can, well, maybe we can sell a little bit of a fairway here, but £1 million in the bank, and then we can re-roof the part of the golf course. We can fix the leak in the clubhouse roof and do something a little different and end up in a better place than they are right now. Because the alternative might be to do nothing and to go back to their unsustainable business model and not exist in 10 years' time.
So I think there's a lot of truth in what you've both said. So so we are facing some significant challenges in the next 5 years plus 10 years, etc. Water availability absolutely going to become a bigger challenge. Pesticide regulations, you know, the EU have already made their decision, you know, it's under review, but they've made a pretty drastic decision to essentially look to ban all synthetic chemicals used in the amenity sector. That includes all of golf and all of sports turf, etc. That's going to be coped with in some sections of Europe. It's going to be a really big challenge in southern Europe, and a really big challenge in northern Europe, the very north, you know, the sort of snow mold type parts. You've got two big slices of our continent that are terrified by this. And you've got a number of you out there saying, hallelujah, it's about time, we need to be moving away from this in a variety of ways. Some things are going to develop. So the technology in our industry is developing at an incredible rate. The biological products are developing rapidly. The machinery is getting more precise. You know, the understanding of what integrated pest management is, the sort of scientific understanding of that. I was asked in a conference a few months ago, you know, can you define integrated pest management? I said, well, actually, it's basically greenkeeping. That's what greenkeeping's always been. You know, you're trying to create a healthy plant, and you do so by using all the methods at your disposal. And the analogy I gave was, I've got a couple of kids, and I want them to be healthy. So we feed them the right food. We make sure they're hydrated. We don't stress them out too much, but we stress them a little bit so that they, you know, they're pushed to do well. We keep them, give them plenty of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
We give them plenty of sunlight. All the things that you do, you know, with your grass plant. But we also keep some Calpon in the cupboard just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that means that every greenkeeper should have a chemical approach. What I'm saying is that in terms of my integrated child management, you know, we rely upon the chemical. We give them vitamins in the morning, but we rely on the chemical only when it's needed because of a particular illness. But we're preventative all the time by keeping them fit and healthy. My kids are fit and healthy. They're both really sporty. Their diets are good. They hydrate really well. And we keep them, we do all the things you should do, you know, fresh air and exercise. And I think the same is true about how you look after your grass plant. And increasingly, you know, from a greenkeeper perspective, we're going back to the past to understand that before we had some of these chemicals, we did a lot of things to make sure that the grass plant remained as healthy as it could be. But you make a really valid point, Mitch, that if this leads to a measurable a deterioration in greens quality, that is going to be something the golfers are going to find very hard to swallow. I accept your point, Sam, and I think you're right that in terms of particularly 3.5-star facilities down, and we don't have a ranking system, but you know what I mean by that, kind of the average golf club down, you know, budgets only go so far, everything's gone up in price, the technology is developing rapidly, but it's expensive. We have to make choices about how much of the golf course is mint. And I think, you know, priority is absolutely going to be for most course managers to make sure the putting surfaces are as good as they can be. Might be looking to reduce the amount of land they manage intensively. Might be looking to reduce, for example, the amount of bunkers on the golf course because they're pretty expensive to maintain or whatever else brings you guys in from an architect's perspective. But I think, you know, maintaining as good a putting surface as you possibly can is going to be the role of the golf course managers for years and years to come. To wrap the original question, Bledge, what's that going to do for the workforce? I think it's going to be a bigger issue for course managers than for anybody else. It isn't going to stop people getting into the industry. It isn't going to force assistant greenkeepers out of the industry, but it is going to be a challenge for course managers, and they're going to need those communication skills we talked about even more as we go through all this. But I do think technology. I've got a little bit of faith that the regulatory environment won't be as drastic as it could be for us. I am nervous that some of the developments are going to mean that one or two of the manufacturers may not invest as much in the future products as they are doing now. So we'll wait and see on that. The forthcoming ban on panel products, you know, who knows what impact that'll have for now, but it could, for example, lead to higher prices, which is a challenge for golf clubs. But I think you raise a point, Sam, that right now, post-COVID, you know, we've got literally, the research proves it, there are 2 million more golfers playing regularly than there were before 2020. We've never had a better opportunity to make our businesses sound, solid, and to invest appropriately. And I think for that, that's investing in drainage, that's investing in irrigation, that's investing in a team of greenkeepers and paying them well so that they look after the facility as best as they can. And that's working closely with that team. Because in the end, as we proved through 2020, when we had the lockdowns, the amount of lockdowns, you couldn't use clubhouses, couldn't use whatever else it is. In the end, the game of golf played outdoors. Clubhouses are important. Spent a bit of time in the wonderful Royal Liverpool one today, but my day wouldn't have been, you know, reduced in value if I hadn't got in the clubhouse. So, you know, the golf course in the end is why we all play.
Tim, you just mentioned the parallel products and we talked about lack of availability. Obviously, we've just touched on it there, but we talked on it when Stressy was on the podcast, Bledge.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that BDS was again involved in trying to advocate for the industry?
Yeah, absolutely. So on two fronts. So first of all, within golf, to try and ensure that golf has a better voice. So working with the RNA closely on Golf Course 2030, etc., and trying to inform the golf industry about the challenges that they're facing. Secondly, this is pretty dull, although I'm happy to say with you, a number of your listeners may well be sort of quite into this situation. It's something I knew more or less nothing about when I joined Bigger. So golf is classed as within the amenity sector. There are three sectors in terms of where chemicals or pesticides influence our land. One is agriculture, which is the big majority and serving the most commercial. One is home and garden, your own gardens. And then everything else is pretty much amenity. So that is anything from the school playing field, a public park, a golf course, a football pitch, but it's also roadways, railways, pavements, Tesco car park, other supermarkets are available. Anywhere where kind of weeds or plants need to be controlled. The amenity sector, that sounds big, and some of those areas are big, you know, keeping our railways clean and our roadways clean are enormous projects, but actually as a sector, we are dwarfed by agriculture. And in fact, the majority of the products that we end up receiving are either agricultural products repurposed, or they're sometimes a unintended byproduct of an agricultural piece of research that said, well, it didn't do what we set out to do, but actually look at this, it controls microducking or whatever it might be, or plant growth regulator or something. So we're in the amenity sector. The agricultural sector is brilliantly represented at a political level by a combination of the NFU and something called the Voluntary Initiative. They've got fantastic voices into DEFRA, because it's DEFRA that make the decisions on chemical regulations. And they've got that trump card. You know, yeah, but you want to eat, don't you? So when, for example, and this is not a criticism, but when we saw all of the pesticides, the insecticides being revoked, which or not being re-registered around leather jacket shave groups or whatever else, agriculture kept certain opportunities because there were some crops that are massively defamed impacted by insects, and if those crop fails, then we have a real problem with food availability and certainly food pricing. So the government gave, I understand this, and DEFRA gave exemptions to certain elements in controlled ways. We are now seeing, we've managed through time, Syngenta have managed to get some emergency authorizations and hopefully in the near future a full-time authorization for Isoniazid, albeit at the rate that we apply it, it's no longer as effective as some of the freezers were. It's still a pretty effective chemical when applied correctly and within the right sort of parameters, but amenity is a smaller voice and golf is a small voice within amenity. So I am bigger as a member of the Amenity Forum, which is our version of the Voluntary Initiative. We have become, the forum has become very good at communicating with DEFRA over the years. I find myself on the board of that because I believe that our part of the sector needs that voice. Works on good people, and we're making some advances. One of the key advances, I think, is that there isn't enough evidence of really good stewardship. Something we talked about on the golf course today was just how targeted our sport, in particular's use of the key pesticides, is. You know, they are often restricted to greens, sometimes restricted even to small parts of greens. You know, greens, teas, approaches at the most in general. Yes, you know, there have been some products reviews across fairways or roughs or whatever, but most of those are kind of disappearing. In the grand scheme of things, it's a pretty small piece of land that's in use. And so we're trying to lobby effectively to make sure that the regulators understand that, because some of the tests, and I think on one of your previous podcasts, you had Dan Lightfoot from Syngenta, who I think maybe talked about some of the hurdles they had to try and get across for one of their most recent products. And some of the hurdles are absurd. They are absurd. This idea that a child is going to come onto your green, lick the turf for 20 minutes, and all these things. And if they did that, they would be. These things just don't happen in golf. But the regulations are there. We've got to work to try and influence them. But we have a looming very quickly. We have an unintended consequence of Brexit. Anybody that knows me will know that, you know, I'm not a fan of Brexit. But one of the unintended consequences of that is that there's a system called parallel products. So when we were in the EU, if a product was registered in the UK, let's just take a fungicide. It was registered in the UK and it was for sale at £600, 80, whatever it was. If that product made by the same company with identical formulation, etc., was for sale in Romania. I don't know why I've chosen Romania, but at a lower price, it was legal for someone to import that at that lower price and sell it at a lower price in this country, which tended to keep prices down because parallel product is the same product, it's identical, therefore you can sell it. So you could buy this, which meant that some of the product prices were kept down. Because that was an EU situation, we don't have those EU agreements anymore. Those products, as of June this year, are no longer available for purchase. So I think, and I might get this wrong, apologies, but I think that the sale of them is finishing this June, and then a year to use up. I think that's the right situation. So that could have, the NFU believe, and the agriculture industry believes, that that will lead to increased prices because the manufacturers will no longer have to compete effectively with themselves from lower economic markets. There is a school of thought that actually that might bring one or two more products into the market because the manufacturers are thinking, well, I sell this for buttons in these markets, so if I brought it into the UK, it wouldn't be worth my while. If they now think, well, actually, I could sell that at what I think is a sensible commercial rate now in the UK because parallels have gone, they might actually pay the money to register certain products. So we might see some more products come on the market for a period of time as long as we have these chemicals to use. But yes, Bigger Bigger has no particular stance on pesticides. I'm a scientist. I did a science degree. I'm pro-science, so I like to try and trust the scientists. And if a product is deemed safe and it's available and is a benefit to some people in the industry, then I don't see why we as an association will stand in the way of that. I'm also pro-education, so we're absolutely in the business of making sure that we educate our members as best we can to cope with a reality where there may well be no pesticides in future.
No, it's a last resort. And Bigger have always taught that at Harrogate. It's always been integrated pest management first. Basics of greenkeeping, the art of greenkeeping. And if it's an absolute last resort, then you would use a chemical. But I think it'll be very tough. And that's the kind of point I was making. If we're trying to keep greenkeepers in this business, then how is the next level of doom and gloom going to hit them? And that was just, I really pray that Bigger and whoever else get together and try and make them see a bit of sense when it comes to this.
Yeah, I think I have a huge amount of faith, or I'm placing a huge amount of faith, should I say, in the RNE's Golf Course 2030 project. They came in at the right time. Congratulations, Mr. Bledger's just killed a fly, which he's been trying to kill for. He's temporarily stunned for the more squeamish of
you. He's absolutely smashed.
Okay, okay. So that'll mean he can enjoy the rest of his podcast. The RNA are ahead of this as much as they can be. They've invested a big sum of money and a lot of time and effort into trying to create what they refer to as a roadmap for golf clubs to navigate the challenges that we're facing. They're around climate change, they're around resource availability and pesticide regulation. And I think people as part of that as well. I've said this a number of times, and apologies for repeating myself, but I really love this idea of a roadmap, because whenever I look at a roadmap, the first thing I do is identify where I am, and then I work out where I want to go, and then I plot the route. And I think if this project comes to the conclusion, I hope it does, it will give, to come back to your point earlier on, Sam, it will give golf clubs the tools to identify where they are. And I think there is an opportunity that maybe Bigger will take a part of in future. It might be the RNA's new sustainable agronomy services. I think the audit of where clubs are in terms of the quality of their drainage, their irrigation system, the soil quality and the topsoil and the soil profile, the quality of their fleet, the size of their staff, their budget for what they're trying to achieve. I think we've got to find a way of allowing clubs to better understand where they are and what their priorities are to move forward. Because in many cases, it is something as simple as absolutely investing heavily in drainage. Could be drainage right now, could be the very thing. You'll know this, Les, from your few years in industry. The way we get rain nowadays is different to how we used to get rain. Mm-hmm. We used to get rain fairly regularly, little and often. Now when we get it, it bombs down. Even we're flooded, whatever else it is, we have the wettest March in, what was it, 10 years?
It's always the wettest, the driest, the coolest.
Same time we're having the wettest, whatever it might be, we're also being told in the news that we might have a hose pipe ban across the country until December.
Yeah, there's already one in place in the southwest.
We had our talk at Wallasey Golf Club with the members, prepare with our proposals for the golf course there. One of the things we touched on was water access, reservoir, drainage across the golf course, all of those things was tying in together. And people were really, I don't know how bothered they'd be about that, but they're really engaged. Mm. I think people understand the responsibility that golf has as a user of space in the current world in which we live, especially going forward. If golf uses water at the moment and it's going to be depleting supply in years to come. Well, where do we stand on the priority list? Are we ahead of homes? Another chance. Are we ahead of industry? Another chance. So we're going to be pretty down on the list of places they're going to turn the taps off to first. So again, it's something that I'm quite passionate about. You need to start thinking about it. Not in 10 years' time when it might be a bit little late when the borehole license you have has been revoked.
And how many clubs across southern England are on mains?
So the last sort of robust research I saw on this was suggesting that 60% of clubs, 65 or 60 clubs, were in some way reliant on mains. But interestingly enough, of those that aren't, boreholes are not always resilient. So the water authorities, the environment agency, have the ability in many cases in the boreholes to reduce your use of that in emergency and extreme.
That's just crazy. It always says it on our licenses. If we've been taken from a ditch, which I've done before, taken from a borehole, it'll say it's this license runs until 2025, and then we're going to reduce it by 60%.
Yeah.
And it's a big number they want to reduce it by.
Or if you can't prove that you are using
it. Yeah, then they'll take it straight away. Yeah, yeah.
And that's gone.
Mm. Absolutely. We end up in a situation where people are potentially using more water than they need to in order to maintain their allocation in the future, which again is a little bit sort of counterintuitive on these areas. So, water resilience is a massively important thing. Having some control over your supply, having reservoirs, they're not cheap. But as I said before, I know we're in a cost of living crisis. I know a lot of clubs are concerned about member retention, etc. But if you have any capital funds available, then things like drainage irrigation, so ability to use water more efficiently, absolutely is important. And water retention. So whether it's anything, I've heard recently of, and there's a number of schemes out there. I think it might be St Pierre Golf Club down in South Wales, who were able to apply to a government grant, which did rainwater harvesting off the roof of their building. That water is used to clean rage balls. They got a grant for doing it. It's been free of charge to them. It's saving umpteen gallons of water a year, and is part of their journey towards being more, or less reliant on mains water.
Yeah, but it's the point I was sort of coming on to before. It's clubs thinking a little more creatively. Or taking the first step, like we don't even have to do it, but to consider the land. A big part of what we do is there are golf courses that they say, oh, we've got no money. And I go and say, well, yeah, but you've got some of the best land for golf that isn't even protected as a dune system or whatever. You could, if you think about outside the box a little bit, move this here, do this, this frees up revenue, you can make some capital from doing this. Look at Matt Plested's podcast that we did about stone, bring in some soil importation.
Yeah.
You can sell a bit of land. You can do so many things to rationalise your estate, which means then that when you put it back together, not only can you be resilient because you built a reservoir, which means that you can have drained the sites, which means that your agronomic basis is probably going to be a little stronger, I mean you're less reliant on some of the chemicals that you might not have access to going forward. But it also means your golfing product that you can give your members is better at the end of it. And, having a pot of cash isn't the only way that golf courses can get better. It's just being a little more inventive is exactly a pledge.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. I think you've seen probably in the proprietary sector, which nowadays I think is probably something like nearly 45% of English golf courses in particular are proprietary owned. I know you guys are working with the guys at Abington. Proprietary clubs probably a little more rapid to be innovative and creative because if you've got a strong leader that sees opportunity, then they'll take that. So, what we've seen in the last 10, 15 years is a huge amount of those 1980s boom golf courses looking to rebuild their sites, go back to housing or merge with the sites and things. It's a challenge for the member-run facility to have the stable, strong governance required to take some of those projects forward. We talked today about some of the clubs that you're talking to. It's sometimes very hard for a committee or a board to hold their bottle long enough in the face of members who are comfortable with change when they're proposing something really quite radical, or your proposals are really quite radical. And the same, that's the challenge we face in terms of trying to, you know, we have a situation where we fix that issue with the governance of the Gulf over its greenkeepers. We're a really happy place. Three community members change in 2 years' time. I said we're back to square one. That's one of the inherent fault lines in golf, I think.
And going back to Big Egg again, we could probably finish up on this if you wanted. The magazine's changing a little bit. Can we discuss that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is interesting. This was yet again another unintended consequence. So as we've been trying to work out how best we made the world a better place for greenkeepers, to go back to our phrase, we've realised, and it wasn't a surprise, we've realised that we need to, we do a reasonable job of communicating inwardly to our own members. We've got to do a bigger and better job at communicating outwardly to the wider golf industry, you know, when that's governing bodies, and also to golfers and particularly to golf club officials and people that's interested in golf, because we've got to try and rise that tide so that all the boats lift. So we had a pretty small communications team, and the magazine was taking up 60-65% of their time, all the time, because we do 12 editions a year. And whilst the magazine is hugely valuable, it's the one thing that you get for your membership and lands on your doorstep every month. We hope that it's of interest, if not all of it, then some of it to all our members. We're pretty proud of it in terms of the job it does for us compared to a lot of the magazines in our sector and beyond. But I wouldn't say it's perfect. But we're looking at how do we improve our communications offer. We really wanted Carl Hansel, who's our head of marketing communications, who was responsible for the magazine, to play a lead role in this. He's developed great relationships across the industry, but he just didn't have the time and the space. So we approached 18 players who we ended up actually outsourcing the magazine to a year or so ago, I think. And talk about, was there a way they could supplement our offering? And we talked about a number of creative ways, and they came after us after a few weeks that we'd given this loads and loads of thought. And we think there's only one way we could actually properly achieve your goal, and that we'd take the magazine off your hands. So instead of having 65% of Carl's time on the magazine, it's perhaps down to 5%. You know, we've got a track record, they've got a track record, they already produced the GCMA magazine. I think they made at the time in discussions with working with the PGA, which means that they're now we've got a bit of a monopoly. We need to be careful about. We like the guys, 18 players, they're golfers. They've got a good track record in our sport and broader.
Dan and Tom and
Dan Murphy, Tom Irwin, Steve Carroll, one of the lead writers who's embedded in golf club culture, and a few other people like Robertson. We like them. They understand us. They produced our Your Course magazine for us. And their previous guys as sports publication.
That was the Your Course was the seasonal, was spring, summer, autumn, winter.
We produced about four or five of those that went out for golfers. We sent out 50 copies, I think, per club, and had them sit on coffee tables in clubs and learn about greenkeeping, try and raise that title a bit, that understanding of greenkeepers. So we talked them at a lot of length. I was pretty nervous. I'm a bit of a control freak, because I think a lot of people in senior positions are, and was worried about how we controlled the quality of the magazine without having absolute insight over every page. We worked through it for a number of months. And the May magazine today is early May. It will be the 2nd of May. Mm-hmm. And this magazine will land with our members in a week or so's time. It is the first one they've produced. It looks a little different in places. It's very much still Greenkeeper International. I really like a lot of the content. I think it'll evolve over time. But the first month has definitely freed up some of our time. But naturally, the first month, there was a fair bit of hand-holding. Carl is already pretty confident that by month three, he will get a significant amount of his time back, as will one or two other members of the team. And we can really start to focus on all the stuff that we really think is going to be more important for the other side of our role, which is promoting greenkeepers as a whole to the industry and improving that respect and appreciation and the way they're valued. We're getting a whole chunk of time. Small increase in cost to us as a business. They're doing us a really good deal, which we believe that we can cover with some of the things that we've got going on. So, yeah, important to us.
Any big changes in it? Or any kind of sneak previews you can give us? Any?
Yeah, the one thing they did, which we really liked, was they streamlined the magazine. We had a meeting with them, and they went through it. And it turned out we'd got something ridiculous, like 14 different sections in one magazine, 268 pages long, and there's adverts or whatever. So they've consolidated that down into five sections, And I like the way they've done that. I agree with their thinking. It's made us think, here's a piece of information. Does it fit one of those five categories? Because if it doesn't, it probably shouldn't be in the magazine. Whereas we were perhaps guilty of going, okay, we'll put that in. Put it in. We'll put a new section around this. So we've got from your association, we've got member interest, we've got education, we've got career development, and now on the spot, I can't remember the fifth.
There's my dogs.
Five sections. Dogs are still in there, don't worry. We'd be in trouble if we were rid of dogs.
Oh, God.
Dogs on course. But it's enabled them to have a better understanding of what works for the magazine, what's important, and to sort of label that up. And it's probably made us a little bit more sort of discerning in terms of how we deal with content. And so when you submit, as you do on occasion, something for our interest, we say, well, actually, does that fulfil this or this? If it does, then actually, we'll give it a go.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, it's an exciting new chapter ahead, I think.
Yeah.
And we thoroughly enjoyed your company today and your double return to the podcast.
Yeah. Maybe in the fullness of time, there'll be a three-peat.
But a three-peat.
I think we'll let you off the time.
They didn't should wait a long time. That's enough of my voice.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for coming on.
No, it's great to speak to you, Jim. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks, and thanks for doing the podcast.
You are a proper golf badger.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we've even got through to that today, and neither should we, but I've loved a sport. I grew up from the age of six on a golf course. I've never worked in anything but golf. It's all I know. I love it. And I was thrilled when you started this podcast. I think that our sector is sort of underrepresented with this. The rest of the golf sector is in some cases even possibly overrepresented. So it's great that we've got this for our part. If this is part of that whole process, you know, listening to some of the ones you've done, talking through the passion and the knowledge that some of our members have or that's come across in the podcast, I think it's going to be good for us.
Mm. No, we love doing it. I mean, we love the guests we've had on. Have been fantastic. So.
Great pleasure having you here again. And to all of you listening, thank you for tuning in and look forward to the next episode, which hopefully won't be too far away. Goodbye.